Park has been a divisive issue in this country.
We're dealing with other things today.
Far too many young couples find it hard to own their own homes. On the things that matter to people.
Is irresponsible and it's wrong and they should...
We have to make sure that we focus jobs and living standards and the National Health Service and schools. People worry about disrespect on the street.
I've always believed...
The British people...
The Right Honourable Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of the UK, founder of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. We're delighted to have...
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this special show. We need to... So let us have a little trip, a little reminder of a speech I gave sometime last year, or maybe even the year before. I will say, by the way, that as of right now, my merit code is still should work until midnight. There's various different settings within how I can set up the coupons, and this is set to run out at midnight, so use the promo code MERIT to get 25% off all courses.
Merit, pure merit, such merit, merit.
I did a bit of the, if you missed it, I did a bit of the redrafting of Jordan Peterson's manifesto, and it literally gave me a headache, and I had to take a Nurofen and go back to bed for a couple of hours to shake off the headache. So in fact, so bad was the headache it gave me that I thought I would have to cancel this stream, but I'm back, I'm fighting fit, I made a full recovery. This stream is fully operational now. This event that has taken place, the so we have been tracking, you know, Tony Blair Institute and, you know, Dark Lord Blair with his network and so on for quite a long time on this channel. But this conference was something of, I would say, a bit of a coming out party for the TBI. And it was also a kind of, I mean, it served as a number of things. It was a passing of the torch, or a kind of Tony Blair giving his formal blessing to Keir Starmer, almost like, do you remember in Revenge of the Sith, Lord Vader, rise? I mean, it's literally that moment as an event. But also, I would say that this this conference was something of a kind of formal announcement, basically, that Blair is back, baby, and this Tony Blair Institute is being humming away in the background, but now it's gonna go kind of, you know, quasi mainstream. It was kind of a, you know, here I am, a display of power, basically, is what it was. And to demonstrate that, before we get to Blair's speech and him interviewing Keir Starmer, I'm going to show you some other highlights from this event so you can see what sort of people were there. But before I do that, let me just give you a little reminder of the octopus diagram I made. Now, do you remember, I made this basically in response to Yarvin, who has always maintained that the head, that is, universities and think tanks and funding bodies and so on, and the mouth, the media, are basically the ones in control of society, and they are the ones who set the tempo. You know, things come out of elite universities and then they trickle down into government and into business, who are basically in hock to the ideas that come out of the head. Okay, that's the Yarvin model. When I presented this, he said I was a Marxist. I double, triple, quadruple, quintuple, 10 times double down on it. And I think that actually since I gave this talk, Scrump and Evelyn, who I will always give a shout out to, in fact, I might make a top 10 people worth watching video just to put Scrump and Evelyn like near the top to try to put them over a bit more. Because week after week after week, those two have basically been showing the receipts. They've been demonstrating in practice how this model is right, basically. For example, they did a stream just last night or the night before on, I think it was on Monday night, where they were talking about how digital ID is already here. And at the start of that stream, they showed that when Tone tried to bring in ID cards back in 2005, LSE put together a whole raft of reasons why they were against it. That's the London School of Economics, okay? One of the most influential universities in this country tried to basically, you know, they opposed the idea of it. Well, if you're Tone, you don't take that lying down. You say, LSE, you don't defy me. If you defy, you don't change me, I change you. And lo and behold, all these years later, who is now writing the white paper, in practice kind of outlining the plan that will bring Blair's digital ID card idea into fruition? None other than the London School of Economics, right? Do you remember in this talk I said academics are the paid shills of power? And what happened? LSE came around to Blair's idea. It wasn't that Power decided, all right, well, we're not going to do the digital ID, we're not going to do the ID cards anymore. Sorry, guys, we got it wrong. No, he didn't let it go. And actually, academia came around to his idea rather than vice versa. And it was a very good demonstration of these sorts of principles. One of the reasons that Blair is so interesting, and one of the reasons that we look at what goes on at the Tony Blair Institute and similar such NGOs, is because he has put himself up here, look, in the network, in the kind of cross section between business and finance, corporations, and all of these various, you know, the NGOs, the World Bank. Blair sits up here somewhere, right? Which is above government. Do you see that? Do you see how it's above what I'm calling the crown and the chamber and the civil service, right? These bodies down here get disciplined by these bodies up here, okay? Yarvin, and I'm not just picking on Moldbug, he really does have a different view to me. He thinks that the media and universities discipline the government and discipline corporations, not the other way around. I think that the chest and the network discipline governments, discipline all of these bodies, and that the media and universities are downstream of them, right? That is my view. I'm a realist. I have studied these things quite extensively, and as far as I can tell, Yarvin is not, basically. I mean, you know, with respect to him, I just do not see how he maintains his thesis in the face of overwhelming evidence. Okay, and what we're about to see, just keep this in mind, maybe pull it up as a tab, right? And we'll see who's talking at this event and where they sit in the general hierarchy. Okay, so the first thing to mention is that, so I'll just remove this. First thing is that I kind of enjoyed the staged, managed arrival of Starmer, with Blair welcoming Starmer into his inner sanctum. Now, this is taking place in Blair's HQ, in his lair, okay? And Starmer is being welcomed by Blair.
Yeah, no, it's going really well, but there's a lot to get through.
Yep.
We're so pleased that you come. There's a lot of excitement in the room and outside the room.
Now, what I like about this is that they're making out as if they don't speak to each other all the time. They're making out like they're strangers. We know, of course, that, I mean, Blair has literally been putting on classes for Starmer. We know that Blair has been managing and stage managing a lot of the Starmer campaign. But this is making it seem like, oh, you know, I haven't seen you for, you know, we barely know each other. Let's watch it again.
Yeah, no, it's going really well, but there's a lot to get through.
Yep.
We're so pleased that you come. There's a lot of excitement in the room and outside the room.
So they're maintaining this pretense here that Blair is just like really grateful that the you know, oh, I'm so grateful that you, Mighty Keir, the actual leader of the current Labour Party, would come to Little Old Tones event. I'm really humbled about it. That you know, and this was a little kind of charade, basically, for the cameras. But let's have a look at the sorts of people who were at this event. So one of the people who was at this event was none other than Jamie Oliver.
School lunches for the most vulnerable kids. Protect our children.
Now, take a look at this, right? That's, what's her name? Is it Kirsty Walk? Tell me if I've got that wrong. Was it Kirsty Walk, for the Newsnight presenter? She is basically the anchor of BBC's Newsnight. Okay? Now think about this. It's Maitlis, not Kirsty Walk. It's Maitlis. But correct me if I'm wrong. She is the presenter of Newsnight, okay? Which is the BBC's anchor, like kind of flagship political commentary show. Yet here she is hosting an event at the Tony Blair Institute. Okay, so it's just kind of interesting for a start that all of these people are clearly of the same class, right? This is the ruling class, remember, and they're all of the same. Oh, she's left apparently, but still, you know, they're all of a piece, right? They're all of a piece. Is the point that I'm trying to make? And there she is turning up to do this, okay? And here, and it gives a kind of veneer of neutrality to the whole thing, I suppose, or like she is able to like transfer some of her, you know, she's just a familiar face that people have seen on TV. And also here's Jamie Oliver, celebrity chef, who is also for some reason on the car. Let's just take a look at what he said.
Against junk food advertising. And if I had a wish for all of your children, it would be that every child left school knowing how to cook 10 recipes to save their life.
So there's Jamie Oliver. Now let's see who else is talking at the Blair Institute.
It's not so much that this stuff is intelligent. The danger is that extraordinarily harmful things can be done with it very, very quickly. And that is something that we all need to be aware of. So when you have something that is that powerful, that potentially damaging, what should we do? How should we think about this? Clearly, we have to come up with regulation. I mean, we regulate cigarettes, we regulate seat belts in cars, we regulate toilet flushes. We have to regulate this stuff.
So there's a businessman asking for regulation. Who else was talking at this event?
About the opportunities that AI brings.
So this is the Director General of the British Chambers of Commerce. Now, I actually had a look. I mean, she's got some pretty epic 80s lesbian vibes. 80s lesbian vibes, right? But she, the British Chamber of Commerce represents about 80,000 businesses, right? There's about 80,000 businesses that this woman is the spokesperson of. So clearly, the British Chamber of Commerce is a pretty important vehicle for the voice of business in the UK.
Well, as the issues, we need to be thinking about global Britain, our trade and inward investment, our people and skills, like a long-term skills programme. We need to be thinking about our high streets and the importance of our local economies and communities, and the green revolution. So we do need to get to net zero. That's really important. But there is a huge opportunity for UK PLC if we can grasp it in terms of new products and services in the green economy. You know, we're the transition generation, right? So I grew up without technology. Mine grew up 100% with it. We are trying to teach our kids stuff that really...
I mean, you didn't grow up with technology, did you? You know, you didn't grow up in bloody 18th century Britain. You grew up with a car and a television. Don't talk about an electricity and a refrigerator and a bloody automated washing machine. Don't talk shit, woman. You did grow up with technology. What she means is they didn't grow up with digital tech, is what she's trying to say.
Truthfully, we don't really understand because we didn't grow up with it. And that is what we really need to get our heads around. And let's remember, 80% of our economy is SMEs.
Very, very concerned about energy costs. But we actually, we've got incredible opportunities with wind power as well, which I think, from my side of things, the organisation I run, we're really looking at getting the design done here, which is what we've always been really fantastic at this country. And unfortunately, it's sometimes seeping overseas. So we want the design.
I mean, turning up at Blair's conference looking like this, very disrespectful, very disrespectful.
Design done here, then you get the manufacturing done.
Is our country a happy place to be? Because that's all that this money should be doing. It should be making us healthy. It should be making us happy. When you're healthy and happy, you work better, you contribute more, society feels better. So I think the joining of those is really, really important.
So there we are. I'm just showing like the range of people who were there, basically. And then who else was there? None other than...
NATO has worked.
A member of the current government, the Tory cabinet minister, Ben Wallace. Now, considering this entire event is basically put on to fluff Keir Starmer, right? This is basically a puff event, basically to say, for Blair to say, look, I'm a major deal. I'm back, guys. And to launch Starmer as the next Prime Minister of the UK. And Ben Wallace, who is a member of the current government under Rishi Sunak, is there speaking. I mean, for fuck's sake. I mean, this is ridiculous. Actually ridiculous.
Throughout this war, an ever more aggressive President Putin, with constant threatening red lines that usually then melt away, he hasn't dared go near NATO. Russia has been very, very cautious of respecting NATO's territory. We have not seen, you know, lashings out into the areas of like Estonia or Latvia. They have been absolutely considerate of Russia, of NATO.
So I just think it's ridiculous that a member of the bloody current government is there. So anyway, that is just a kind of cross section of the sorts of people who were there. And this is what the events that Blair is at is always this cross-section of people from business, people from big corporations, representative of business, and then people from, you know, government and the major parties and so on and so forth. It's always that, what do they call it, public-private, right? So if you remember the... if you remember the octopus diagram, let me just put it up again. You see, Blair, I've got him sitting over here, right? But what he does in the UK is that he is an interface between all of this and all of this down here, because he understands how all of this works down there. So what Blair does is that he gets talking points from up here and he filters them down into down here. And he tried, I mean, we've seen him talk. I mean, do you remember a couple of weeks back, he was talking to Microsoft and that thing on AI. The whole point of that event on AI was basically so they could see the talking points for a conference that's coming up where all the different leaders are going to be there, right? So what he does is that he gets the kind of thinking from all of here, and he sells it. He basically sells it as a package to all of these people down here, right? And then, as we've seen, these characters are just, they're just kind of, you know, people to get eyeballs on it, or they're paid shills, basically. As you saw, like, Maitlis and Jamie Oliver, and, you know, they probably gave Deborah Meaden a couple of quid to turn up or whatever, and they get to feel important to be at these sorts of events. But that is basically Blair's role in the Octopus, as an interface between these four areas here, right? He sits somewhere in between as a kind of point man, right? And remember, all of the different streams that we've done looking at the money flow that comes, in fact, it goes from corporations like Microsoft, the money goes from them into one of these foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and then it flows from the foundation into an NGO, Tony Blair Institute, and then the NGO uses its networking skills to filter policy down into the Crown, who then, you know, it's their job to discipline the chamber to actually do what they want. Now, the Tory party is incredibly weak, and one of the problems that the Tory party have had while in government is that they keep on, they're unable basically to discipline the chamber. The chamber ends up disciplining them all the time, like making Dominic Raab resign and saying, "I actually, Prime Minister, we can't do that." So they have got an unruly civil service at the moment. Whereas when Starmer gets in power, he will kick the shit out of them, as Blair did, because they know what they're doing. Okay, so that is just a kind of overview, kind of simple high level, kind of high 10,000 feet overview. Obviously, it's much more complicated on the ground, but that is basically, you know, the flow chart as I see it. Okay. So let us have a look then now at Blair's opening speech to kick all of this off.
Wow. I mean, okay, so I'm a lot more optimistic about the future of Britain following that. Actually, my staff had a conversation, and one person said, you know, I've got this really great idea.
Now think about this. He turns up at an event at his own institute, gets a big round of applause and goes, "Oh, wow, thanks for giving me a great round of applause, guys." However, because it is he's at home, he doesn't have to do his usual kind of Mick Foley cheap pop, you know, "It's great to be back in Swindon" or whatever. He doesn't have to do that at this, because he is actually the host of this event. So
we should start with the very young, and then by contrast. Okay, so unusually for me, given my natural optimism, let's start with the bad news. Britain's situation is perilous. We need policies which short-term, i.e. within one parliament, will get the economy moving, and we need a long-term plan for the country's future. We can debate how we got here, but where we are is grim.
Grim. It's grim. Prophets of Doom, ladies and gentlemen, out in 2 months' time. Academic agent with his finger on the zeitgeist and the pulse. And what does that book start with? A quote from Tony Blair being optimistic 20 years ago.
The British state is unsustainable. We are spending more than ever before in British history, except in times of crisis or war, and taxing more with poor outcomes. Waiting lists trebled since 2010. Crimes leading to a charge, a third of what they were even in 2015. This generation, half as likely as the last, to be homeowners by the age of 30. and 2 million children in receipt of free school meals, and that's a third above the long-term average.
Grim.
Now, all our competitors, it's true, have seen falls in growth and productivity since the financial crisis. But Britain has fallen most.
Let me just go back there. He's going to say, and I kind of know this because I've already seen this, spoilers, I've already seen this, but he's going to try to pin that extra, the fact that we're doing worse than France, he's going to try to pin that on Brexit.
Has fallen most. And what that does is it depletes further still the money available for public spending.
Now, what's incredible, by the way, is that earlier on, Blair was on Peston. And on Peston, right, they set up his interview on Peston with exactly the same set of graphs. It's literally like Blair said, here's my deck, just present them, and that's going out on ITV 1045. So, I mean, that whole appearance on Peston earlier on was yet another massive Blair puff piece just planted into a major ITV show where he basically gave the kind of idiot note versions of this talk in his interview with Peston. And of course, it was a massively softball interview. So he got all his talking points nailed, and he actually got the show to present his slides before, you know, before he even appeared. So
taxes and receipts would be £130 billion higher if we kept pace just with the G7, not with the growth.
I love, by the way, that he uses 2007, the day he left office, as the starting point of 100. Notice that he cuts it off just before he leaves power. Intimation being, things were great when I was in power. Then that shithead Gordon came in, and, you know, then we've had Tories after that. Things were great when I was in power, look. But the deviation comes the minute I stepped out of number 10.
In the early part of this century. And meaning that since 2007...
Since 2007, when I was last in power, things have been bad. Vote Starmer, get Blair 2.0. That's basically the subtext here. It's not that subtle, to be honest.
The average UK worker has received no real pay rise. Now, Brexit, it's had a significant impact. The UK foreign direct investment inflows are at their lowest level since the 1980s. And business investment, British business investment, has underperformed since Brexit. All of that.
He's not wrong, by the way, of course, because as we know, Tome was great, wasn't he, guys? Tome was great. So, but yeah, I mean, these are official stats. These are like proper stats. So it's not like he's making this stuff up.
That is for sure. And the Brexit damage is unique to Britain. But the structural challenges are the same all over the developed world and are the product of a combination of deep economic societal change together with profound policy dysfunction, where the actions of the state have not kept pace with what is happening in the real world. Because it's not just the level of spending, but the composition, which is alarming. So spending in areas necessary but unproductive has risen much faster than investment in areas essential for future economic success. Over the last 3 decades or so, spending on disability benefits increased more than increased spending on education, spending on social care more than transport, increased spending on pensions more than housing and research and development increases combined. Health spending increased by a massive $165 billion, more than all the productive areas put together, but only an extra $6 billion of that $165 went on capital investment. And, yep, the pressures are going to get worse because of an aging population. Another 3.4 million elderly in the next 20 years with the...
We are fucked. I'm just saying, like, for Tone to be saying things are grim, things have to be pretty grim. This is dire, by the way. This is a dire situation that we're facing. I mean, he's not wrong about this. We are fucked in this country, unless something happens.
Over 50s today, holding 78% of the housing wealth. So...
78% of the private wealth in the country is held by boomers, essentially, and old Gen Xers. Brilliant.
We've got two challenges. One, to make the state sustainable. And second, to raise Britain's growth and productivity levels and become leaders in the economy of the future. And both require fundamental reforms. The question is how. And finally, here is some good news. We live through an era of unprecedented technological advance. This 21st century technology revolution is every bit as radical in its effect as the 19th century industrial revolution.
And as always with Blair, we have to jump on the steam train, which goes 200 miles an hour. Do not stop. Do not pass go. Do not collect £200. We have to go directly there at the fullest speed possible. Ain't that right, Tone? There's no other choice. It is inevitable that we have to jump on board this technological revolution.
Now, like any change, it has risks as well as opportunities. But already, just look at how dramatically it has changed the nature of the private sector. Compare the top 10 global companies today and at the turn of the last century. The purple are the tech. Three in July 2003, now 8 out of the 10. And not only service companies, but new manufacturing ones. And their behemoths. In 2003, the largest company was General Electric, just under 300 million market cap. Today, it's Apple at 3 trillion.
3 trillion. Jesus Christ.
That is, by the way, more than the annual GDP of the whole of the French economy.
Holy shit. Apple has got a larger market cap than France. So, is Tone going to say what we have to do rather than control these massive behemoths, as he called them? I think Tone is going to say, actually, we need to sidle up to these massive companies and basically accept that they are our new overlords. I reckon that's what he's about to say.
And if you take the top 20 economies in the world and match it with the 8 top tech companies' market cap, you get a sense of the size of the change. What's more, their research and development spending is vastly superior to government. 5 of the tech giants invest more than Britain's government.
Ah, the R&D spend of Microsoft is bigger than the entire United Kingdom. The R&D spend of Apple is bigger than the entirety of France and the UK. Meta spend more than France and the UK. Alphabet, which is Google, have got a bigger R&D spend than France and the UK and Korea. Jesus Christ. I mean, there are other ways to think about this, by the way. Like an old-fashioned way to be would be like, we have to break these companies. That is just too much power for a private institution, an unelected government, to have that many resources, right? Like, one way of thinking about it would be, like, we need to use the state to bring these companies under control. But that's not what Tone is about to say. Tone is going to say, actually, we need to embed these companies into the infrastructure of the country because they've got the money and we don't. So basically, we need Apple or Microsoft or some other massive company to pay for our infrastructure spending. That's what he wants to say here, right? That when they talk about public-private partnership. What they're talking about is the complete fusion of these massive multinational corporations with governments, right? I mean, globalization, in the way that Blair is thinking about it, is basically creating this new massive kind of, octopus, you might say.
And Amazon alone, three times as much.
It's basically inverse. It is inverse fascism. In fascism, it is corporations under the state, right? State-directed corporations. What we've got here is actually a lot closer to the model in South Korea, where the distinction between Samsung and the Korean government, well, they might as well be the same thing. And what Blair is saying is that we basically need to formalize. We need to make Microsoft, Apple, Google, we need to basically just make them the government or on par with the government, because basically they've got a shit ton of money that we don't have. So we need them to work with us so they can pay for shit. That's basically his plan here. I think it's scary. It's basically Skynet, or, you know, this is a form of corporatism that, and in fact, I was reading Joseph Schumpeter's book the other night, you know, the famous one, what's it called? Socialism and Democracy or something like that. You know, it's the famous book where Schumpeter talks about creative destruction. And what Schumpeter says in that book is that capitalism is doomed, basically, to no longer exist in its entrepreneurial kind of Austrian form, right? The old capitalism that we think of, where it's entrepreneurs and the free market and so on. He says it's doomed to failure, but it's not doomed to failure for the reasons that Karl Marx thought it was. It's doomed to failure because corporatism, that is this fusion between the state and massive multinational corporations, is basically inevitable at some point in the future. He wrote that book in 1942, by the way. And this is basically Schumpeter's hell future happening right before our eyes. Tell me I'm wrong.
So, we're in the middle of this tech revolution. You've got big data, mobile and cloud, artificial intelligence, and now a new revolution through generative artificial intelligence. And here's how some of the people are describing it.
I mean, what he doesn't mention is that Bill Gates is the number one funder of the Tony Blair Institute. If it wasn't for Bill Gates, Blair wouldn't have this massive infrastructure that he's got. In fact, they are one and the same. There is no distinction between Bill Gates and Tony Blair, if you want to put it that way. They are one and the same. Note, Brad Smith is also a Microsoft man, right? We have already seen some aspects of the formalization of this in the 2020 election, when Twitter, as it was then, and Facebook and Google all banned the President of the United States from their platforms. That was basically a declaration of power by these tech giants. And what Blair wants to do is basically make those ties even deeper between our institutions and the government and these massive corporations.
It's like the invention of the printing press. It's going to be the most beneficial technology for humanity ever. That's from our own Demos. We're only at the beginning of what AI can accomplish. Whatever limitations it has today will be gone before we know it, from Bill Gates. And already, tech is changing how we live, the way we shop, what we watch, even how we date, and the jobs we do. And now...
By the way, that stat there, 16 to 24-year-olds spend 65 minutes per day watching YouTube and just 11 minutes per day watching the BBC. That's all of you guys. That's all of you. You're watching me instead of the BBC, so maybe it's not all bad, eh? I love you, Neil Mohan. Come back, Susan. Come back.
This is going to accelerate at a faster pace than ever before. And here's the challenge. though the world is changing, the state is not.
Look at that stat, by the way. I just want to go back. Amazon delivers more than 5 billion parcels in the UK each year. And at least 1 million of those are books to my house.
Though the world is changing, the state is not. These are the main areas of public service employment and the changes since the end of last century. The composition of the jobs is largely unchanged. There's just more of them. In addition, we have no national data infrastructure in health or across government, no digital ID, which is preconditional for a fully digital state, few incentives for public sector innovation, and at least until recently, no drive from the centre to engage with the transformation of government that is possible through technology. Yet this technology revolution allows us not just to reform the state, but in time to reimagine it entirely. How it operates, who it employs, what it does. A state that's more strategic, which is empowering, not overpowering, and where it works with the private sector in partnership to create...
I mean, do you remember what I said about disciplining the chamber? This is Blair being like, all of you civil servants who have been such a pain for the Tory party, when we get in, we're going to replace you with robots. Ha ha! Suck on that. What was his name in... what was that old show, the one the British loved? Yes, Minister. Do you remember all those guys in Yes, Minister? This is Blair being like, listen, I remember when I was in power how much of a pain in the arse you guys were. You're going to get replaced with robots when I get back in. You're on notice, all of you.
Create the economy of the future. Just two examples. Take health. Individual factors, we know, are the biggest determinants of illness and are preventable, with personal choices and behaviours alone causing half of all illness. And we're learning what technology can do to change it in prevention, detection, and cure. So proper use of NHS data could save up to £10 billion a year, and that was according to a 2019 assessment.
What does this mean, though, Blair? What does this mean, proper use of NHS data? Right? You've just said that half of all illnesses are personal choices and behaviours. And now you're saying that data could prevent that. So what? I'm going to have an app on my phone that has got all of my medical data on it. And it's going to go like, beep, 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 beep. That's the second burger you're having this week. You may want to consider having a salad instead, eh? Or maybe even worse. I go to pay with my phone for the burger and the machine goes, no, not allowed, not allowed. You have had your fat for this week, you fat fuck. Have a salad instead. I mean, what exactly does he mean by the use of NHS data? In real-time NHS data can reduce hospitalisation by 60%, right? He's talking about all of our medical records being used in some algo in order to modify everybody's behaviour. There's nothing else that can be taken from what he's just said. He hasn't said it out loud, but that is ultimately what he's saying here. Tell me I'm wrong.
NHS data could save up to £10 billion a year, and that was according to a 2019 assessment. It'll be much higher today. According to a report just issued last week, real-time data could help reduce hospitalizations by 60%. 30 million...
Yeah, real-time data, like, how's it going to help? Unless you're going to be surveying what people do, those 50% of personal choices and behaviors are going to have to be controlled. So basically you're talking about using data to control people's choices. That's ultimately the only thing he can be talking about here. Monitoring from their wearables can improve lifestyles and detect a whole range of illnesses. Monitoring. 30 million people now use the NHS app, which could form the basis of a personal health account. Don't know, it's sounding a little bit like social credit, Tone. Only for health, right? Only for health. It's for your own good. Don't eat those fries, because you might get cancer. Don't eat that ready meal. Jamie Oliver, the Jamie Oliver AI, tells you no ready meals. I mean, the thing is, I can see people, especially people on the more kind of fashy end of things, on our side of things, going for this, right? The basis on which to oppose what Blair is suggesting here really has to come from a liberal place, not an, like, if you're really up for the state using power. And, you know, I mean, I've talked to people on our side of things who would force people to go to, like, camps, to fitness camps and things like that, fat camps. You know, so, like, I'm not saying that you should necessarily disagree with those things. I'm just saying if this comes in, it's going to be a massive change to what we're used to.
People now use the NHS app, which could form the basis of an electronic health record. And monitoring from wearables can improve lifestyles.
And can you imagine on your phone, there's like a, like, every time there's like a, every time you go to make an unhealthy choice, Jamie Oliver's fat kind of tongue face, you know, there's a Jamie Oliver alarm on your NHS app that every time, access denied, consider having a salad. Consider having a salad. Consider having a salad. Consider having a salad.
And in time, we'll be able to detect a whole range of illnesses. Then genomics can identify risks, help prevent disease. Cell and gene therapies and messenger RNA are opening up new possibilities in curing disease, including cancer and heart disease. And, of course, AI. But lung disease is already in clinical trials. Clinical trials themselves will be dramatically changed, and developed drugs and AI-enabled technologies will be able to detect eye disease, cancer, heart disease, and strokes. And of course, automation through AI can ensure healthcare professionals have more time to spend on direct patient care. So when we talk about NHS reform in the future, utilizing technology is going to be fundamental to that reform. A second example, modern cloud systems, by combining different sets of data, could help target state interventions and save money. It's just two: furlough support during COVID, household support in the energy crisis, huge and targeted interventions. Now, even if we say...
Now, when he's talking about targeting here, what he's talking about is, he's basically saying that loads of people got furloughed, didn't need it. Oh, what's wrong? What's wrong? Why did everything stop? Are we back? Are we back? We're back. Just press one if you can hear me. Press one. I think that was on the StreamYard's. What happened there then? Are we back? Back in action? Okay, we're back. No, I didn't know. I think something happened. Something happened on... Okay. So, I don't know. I got a drop as well. Everything stopped for me too. And all of the Vs went down to zero. I don't know what that was. MI5 checking in, basically. But what I was saying back here, if I don't know how much of, if you missed anything that I talked about, let's just go back a little bit. You got all my stuff about the Jamie Oliver app and all that, right? Jamie Oliver stuff, yeah. I think it was just a YT server problem, because I can see everybody's back now. So, all right, let's carry on.
Example. modern cloud systems, by combining different sets of data, could help target state interventions and save money.
Right, now, what I understand, right, what I understand him saying here, right, is that basically loads of people got furloughed who didn't need it. And that if they had basically targeted furlough to people who were below a certain threshold, they could have saved like $50 billion, £50 billion. People are saying that YouTube broke site-wide for a moment, right? But anyway, what I think he's saying here is that you can means test the people who could have had furlough. They did it blanket, right? They did it blanket. But now, with the use of AI, they could have just stuck everybody's data in and being like, no, not you, Fred, not you, Jim, not you, Charlie. You're all on over 50K. You don't get any money. No money for you. No money for you. No soup for you. That is what Blair is saying here, that with targeted costs, they could have like given loads of people, not given everybody a furlough, pretty much. Same with the energy stuff.
It's just two, furlough support during COVID. Household support in the energy crisis. Huge and targeted interventions. Now, even if we saved a fraction of those sums, it would be massive. There's more good news. This is a revolution in which Britain and British business can play a crucial role. Because technology is also the key which unlocks Britain's industrial future. Britain has big advantages in this new economy. It's got world-class universities, the largest finance sector in Europe, third behind the US and China in venture capital, the leader in Europe for artificial intelligence talent, and fourth globally for so-called unicorns, that's startups valued at over $1 billion. But we're slipping. So UK IPOs have declined to just 5% of the global total, which reduces the attractiveness of London as a financial centre. We don't have enough compute capacity. We've got declining AI research papers. Only one of the 27 major advances in synthetic biology of the past decade have come from the UK. And FDI in our life sciences fell by 47% last year.
Every single one of these stats is like a nail dagger through Tone's heart. Ugh! 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 I mean, it's not good, to be honest. UK should be leading all of these things, but it's not.
My point is very simple. None of these things are hard to fix. They just need the full concentrated focus of government to fix them. And here is the big political message. This technology revolution isn't an interesting sideshow on the margins of traditional politics. It should change them as completely as it's changing the world. Of course, like any technology, there are dangers. Now, I've concentrated today on the opportunities, but we could do a whole other presentation for you just on the risks, which are also huge. But in political terms, small p political terms, it goes to the same point. Understanding, mastering, and harnessing the 21st century technology revolution is the 21st century progressive political mission. In the same way that ultimately, mastering the 19th century industrial revolution became the mission, first, of the Liberal Party in the 19th century, and then the Labour Party over 100 years ago. Otherwise, for progressive politics, the danger is it retreats to a version of old-fashioned state intervention, which now manifests itself in anti-globalization sentiment, forgetting the enormous benefits open trade and markets have brought.
I mean, I just want to mention that the plan that he outlined was massively state interventionist. just in a direction that he wants, right? And a direction that business is already going in. So what Tono always wants to do is he wants to give business a helping hand to carry on going in the direction that he's already decided is inevitable. He's just said that we need to put all our focus into making sure these things happen, basically, right? Because they wouldn't do it on their own. That is state intervention, right? But he's saying, like, we have to do it in this way, not in the kind of Corbyn way where you're just giving money to poor people, essentially.
The world, or a new-fashioned identity politics, which risks mirroring the divisiveness of the far right, not defeating it. So that is our basic analysis. However, we live in the here and now.
That stuff about identity politics, by the way, was a nod to like putting woke away. It's like, don't talk about BLM and stuff. Like, just that's all a distraction from this dark shit that I want to do, right? Don't talk about your bloody women and gays and stuff, because that gets in the way of all of this. It's basically what he said. And it, what does he say? Risks mirroring the rhetoric of the far right.
This is all about the future, but the here and now. Ryan Wayne, who is one of our great hopes at TBI, is now going to outline for you the four things that we could do in the first years of any parliament to get growth going. Ryan, over to you.
So very much the tone of this was, look, shit is grim. It doesn't need to be this grim. If only we get the adults back in the room, the sensible centrists, the serious people who care about important things like facts and figures and science and technology. That was basically Tone's message. So now, there was a speech by Keir Starmer. I watched that speech and he echoed many of the things that Blair said, and he outlined these kind of five missions, and he talked about the importance of mission-based politics. The reason I'm not going to go through that is because, to be frank, it's really boring. Starmer has got a real problem, ladies and gentlemen, and that is that he comes across like Arnold Rimmer from Red Dwarf, right? He's got a nerdy voice. He's got a nasal. He's like, my five missions, right? I'm holding my nose. He's got a very nasal, nerdy voice, and he sounds like Arnold Rimmer. And he's not very charismatic, and he's boring. Okay? On the one hand, that's bad, because he has no charisma whatsoever. On the other hand, if the message is the boring, technocratic, managerial adults are back in the room, you don't have to worry about the clown show of Corbyn, and you don't have to worry about the clown show of Boris and people like that, because the adults are back, maybe the lack of charisma of Starmer won't be as much of an issue as we think it will be. However, I think the risk for this project and the risk of... I mean, there's two risks, I would say, for Labour right now. The first risk is that they get a bit complacent and they think that they've already won. We saw with Hillary Clinton how dangerous that is, to think that you've already won. Okay, and I think there are signs that Labour think they've already won, even in this conference today. Okay, that's one risk they've got. The second risk they've got is that Tories, out of desperation, could go back to Boris. And I believe that in any election, despite all of the terrible stuff the Tories have done, Boris could beat Starmer. Why? Because Boris is likeable, he's charismatic, he's bigger than life, everybody knows him, he can correctly say I was buggered over by the system, he can dial up the populism, the fake populism that we know Boris is so good at, and that could save the Tories' bacon. Or the Tory sausages. Wasn't it sausages he used to like carrying in that stupid hat that he was wearing? So those are the two risks, I would say, for this new Labour 2.0 project. complacency on their part and a return to Boris. Saving those two scenarios, and I will say that Starmer is a really realistic guy, listening to him, as we're about to see. I don't think number one is going to happen, because these guys, these guys know their stuff. Even in 1997, we've been rewatching the 97 election. Even on that night, Peter Mandelson was like, "Well, we haven't won yet. We haven't won yet." Even like when the after the exit poll had come in, Mandelson was like, "No, we're not counting on our chickens yet." Right, until the results were in. So they always have an eye on reality, these guys. So I don't think number one's going to happen. I don't think number two is going to happen, because the Tories are just so feckless, so crap, so utterly useless that they won't do that. And it is the only thing, I'm telling you now, the only thing that will say. Rishi Sunak today, right, his approval rating came out. He has a 25% approval rating. 25%. That's lower than Joe Biden, lower than Trump at any point in his, right? He has a 65% disapproval rating and a 25% approval rating with the public, okay? Those are historically low figures. Awful, like worse than John Major numbers, okay? So that's bad. That is bad for Sunak, okay? In the face of that, what did he do today, Sunak, right? Did he throw some red meat at the gammon? Did he, I don't know, try to do something that would make people like him better? Nah. He apologized for the historic treatment of LGBT veterans in the British military. Yeah, that's what Sunak did. In the face of this, in the face of everybody saying the next Starmer government is inevitable, in the face of historic unpopularity, he comes out and he basically does the gayest thing possible. He apologised for historic treatment of LGBT people in the army. Useless cunt.
I think we're down here. Hi.
You good?
Which one are you? Am I here?
Fantastic.
Well, this is a first. So, thank you very much indeed for coming. I'm really, really...
Not from a Jedi.
Pretty grateful. Thank you so much for the speech. Before we get on to the substance, how are you enjoying Prime Minister's questions?
I'm a bit out of practice.
But he's not turning up.
I haven't seen him for 3 weeks. We got one tomorrow, and then I think only two more before conference. So, I think I'm more than anyone else.
Yeah, that's something I really don't miss, you know.
Yeah.
Even now, wherever I am in the world, sort of midday Wednesday, I think I've got this uneasy feeling. I know that's what it was.
I think at least you moved it from twice a week into once a week.
Yep.
So that's only on a Wednesday at 12.
It's a small number of people who should be grateful to me, but they should be very grateful.
I
mean, this event is meant to be putting Starmer over. Blair is so charismatic, it's putting Blair over, which is a bit of a problem that Starmer's got. Throughout this interview already, Blair is the one who's being like, yeah, I did do that. All right, great, you know. Did I ever tell you about Darth Plagueis the Wise?
Keep reminding the Shadow Cabinet that back in the day, the Prime Minister used to sit on the front bench and choose which of his ministers would answer the question. Yes, so we could go back to that model.
Yeah, I mean, we never know what they're going to say, though. That's the thing. you've done an amazing job. You've taken the Labour Party in 2019. It was on the brink of extinction, frankly.
Well done, my Padawan. You have carried out my orders well.
And you've taken it. I know you can't say it's on the brink of government, but I think it's a pretty good prospect. And yet, I think we both agree that 1997 is very different
from 2024. You know, in 1997, we had a lot of things to do, but on the other hand, we could see that growth had stabilized and we could look forward to over 2% trend growth. What you're going to inherit next year is, I mean, as I said earlier, it's grim, right?
Yeah, it's going to be really tough. But I think this point about the mood of the country is really, really important, because now we've got...
A lot of people are pointing out in the chat that basically Starmer's come as Blair Jr., right? This is a bit like when Anakin dons the cloak and he actually becomes a Sith Lord. To become a true Tone apprentice, you have to don the Tone uniform. That's a suit without a tie. Remember, a suit without a tie. And, of course, he's come as Mini Blair. So there we go. This is a formal passing of the torch.
To a position where we're a credible contender, and that's all we are. We've got a lot of work to do. People are looking back.
And he's doing the blade. And he's doing the Blair blades as well. of course, just like Darth Vader, he can't do lightning. Vader can never do lightning, right? But that's reserved just for the master.
When this last happened, and we've, I mean, as you know better than anyone, we've only won from opposition three times. And obviously, 97 was the last time. And the mood then was one of growing optimism. That song, Things Can Only Get Better, that resonated because it felt that was the mood of the country at the time. The economy was growing and, you know, what Labour was able to come in and absolutely sort of turbocharge that sense that we're going to go into a new century, it's a new way of doing politics, modernising, things can only get better.
Things can only
That's
get
not the position
better.
By a long shot. The economy is badly damaged. Public services are... I say on their knees. My wife, who works for the NHS, would say on their face. And the mood of the country...
That is actually true, by the way. My wife has had a lot of reason to go into hospitals recently for, you know, various different reasons. Including, that's why I couldn't do UO last night, by the way, because I had to go back and look after AAA. And, I mean, the stories I've been getting from her about the state of the hospitals at the moment. She was saying that there were doctors and nurses on the floor. She said, you know how tired people are when they go slightly kind of zombified? She's just like, everybody walking around those hospitals is like they're in a kind of zombie-like trance state. They're just that overworked. They're that tired. You know, I mean, a couple of weeks back, my 97-year-old neighbour fell and hurt her ankle. She had to be rushed into hospital. I think she's 98 now, actually. It took A&E over 12 hours to give this 98-year-old woman a bed. 12 hours it took for them to see her. I mean, it is mental, the abject state of our hospitals in this country. It is just horrendous. Nothing. I mean, it's not just that, it's everything. I mean, Scrump and Evelyn were talking the other day about just kind of seeing somebody from your local council or any public facing kind of state services whatsoever. Nothing works. It's a shambles. It really is. And not just kind of, this is not just like normie politics now. The country is barely fucking functional. And that's happened in my lifetime. It wasn't like that when I was a kid or under Blair or even in the early years of Cameron, that was not the case. But it really is on its ass right now. You know, basically third world.
I think is pretty bleak. And I think many people fall into two camps. The camp that says to me, I like what you're saying, your missions, the change that I think you would bring about, but can you do...
This is the other thing that my wife was saying as well, by the way, when it comes to that. She said that now the nurses don't do like kind of bedside manner stuff anymore and they don't use any common sense, right? So one of the people who was in hospital, their temperature was going up to like over 40, right? So they're getting hot flushes and then it was going like down to like normal temperature and then up and then down, like hot and cold flushes. And this nurse, basically, rather than kind of taking note of what was happening or listening to what the people who'd been waiting there were telling her, she basically took a measurement, looked on the computer, looked at a screen, looked at the thing on the screen that said, oh, this means it's all right. Oh, yeah, it's fine. He can go. It's like, hold on a second. This person may, like, what are you talking about? They can just go. So, I mean, and this is the sort of thing that happens more and more. It's just people just are just glued to a kind of, they're just looking at data and they aren't actually using any intuition or common sense or anything to make kind of like a human assessment of what's happening. So anyway.
Do it? Can you do it? It seems too broken to me. And then another group that say, will you do it? We've been lied to so much in the last 13 years, we don't actually believe anything anybody says. So the mood is very different. The reason it matters, I mean, it's not...
And he's right about that. All of you, if Starmer came up to you and said, I understand what you're saying, I'm going to make all these changes, you wouldn't believe him. Nobody watching this would believe Starmer. So he's right about that.
Just a sort of historic, interesting analysis. We have to get the mood of the country right because we have to speak to the country where it is now and not where we'd like it to be. And therefore, it's a mistake to us to speak to the country as if it's 1996. We've got to speak to the country as it is in 2023.
Right, and they want a sense of realism.
Yeah. Reassurance. They want hope, of course, but the reassurance has to come first. Do you get it?
Based realism.
Do you know how bad things are? Do you know how much I'm struggling? Can you fix the immediate problem? And can you deal with the longer-term fundamentals that we need to fix?
I'm personally a fan of the five missions because here's what I think they do, which I think is really important in this context. I mean, if you take over from Rishi Sunak next year, you will be the sixth prime minister in 8 years. And in the previous 36,
you will take over from Rishi Sunak next year. I have foreseen it.
I think we had five. So, but not only have we many prime ministers, but they've all been very different from each other, right? So David Cameron, Theresa May was very different from David Cameron. Boris Johnson was very different from Theresa May. Sunak was...
There was one in the middle there. Trust.
Easy
to overlook.
Yeah, well, she was very different. So the thing is, what that does, I think this is really important.
By the way, just think about what's happening, right? Blair is once again alphaing Starmer. Blair's meant to be interviewing Starmer, but he's taking over now. He's just like, yeah, listen, you're boring, mate. I'm going to talk because people listen to me. I'm going to get over your five missions.
Because what that does is it means you cannot have a consistent government policy, right?
Yeah.
So I think what is really important to me about these missions is that they set clarity of direction.
It's so important that we have mission-driven government for all those reasons. I think the single biggest failure of the last 13 years is failing to grow the economy. If we'd grown the economy in the last 13 years, as well as you grew it in the 13 years before that under the Labour government, we'd have tens of billions of pounds to spend on public services without altering tax at all. One of the reasons we haven't grown it is all that chopping and changing. And when we say we've had three prime ministers in the last year, four chancellors and four budgets, that is politically funny. It makes for really good cartoons. It's a disaster when it comes to investment and strategic thinking. And so part of the task we will inherit is bringing stability to government and ensuring that our projects are clear, they're focused, they're realistic, and that we stick to it over the long term and don't move around and chop and change. I've spoken.
Notice, by the way, it's sad, but the energy, every time Starmer speaks, the energy in the room goes down. Every time Blair speaks, the energy in the room picks back up. It's a problem. He's going to have to be coached somehow.
You know, we were at Davos together. We spoke to no end of investors who say to me, it's not that we don't have the money to invest in some of the projects in Britain that need investment. It's that we don't see the conditions of certainty right at the moment that will allow us to come alongside a government and actually deliver. And that's why the missions are strategic, long-term. They're about the what change you're going to make, growing the economy, NHS for the future, green power, you know, smashing the class ceiling, and security in our communities, but also the how. How are you going to do this? How are you going to get business to partner alongside you and deliver on these missions? And that's why we're having a row at the moment about tough choices.
Yep.
Because we need the stability in our economy is absolutely vital as a stepping stone to getting onto those missions.
So when people say, look, you should be making all these spending commitments and...
Well, my first reaction, you know, we keep saying collectively as a party, we've got to take tough decisions. And in the abstract, everyone says, that's right, Keir. And then we get a tough decision. We've been in one of those for the last few days, say, well, don't like that. Can we just not make that one? I'm sure there's another tough decision somewhere else that we could make. But we have to take the tough decisions. And this isn't, you know, this isn't some sort of reflection on some focus group that says, you know, we'd like Labour to have an economic straitjacket on. It's the fundamentals. Liz Truss was very different to others. She proved the thesis that if you make unfunded commitments, then the economy is damaged and working people pay the price.
Right, and that could be tax or spending, right?
That could be tax. For her, it was unfunded tax cuts, but it could be unfunded spending. So if you want proof that unfunded commitments cause economic damage, which is then, you know, visited on working people, you've got a living example of that. And that can come from both sides.
I'll tell you something. When I watched this earlier, I watched it in the car, which obviously meant I was just listening to it on the speakers. I couldn't actually watch it. And weirdly, Starmer may have that Richard Nixon thing where he comes across better when you're listening to him on the radio than when you're actually watching him. I don't know what that is, but he comes across better when you can just hear his voice and you can't see him. He's very dull. I will give you that.
Politics. And so it's a fundamental. I will not let the next Labour government get anywhere near the equivalent of what Liz Truss is. Because it will... But it is also, for that investment, we need to partner with business to get these missions done, because they're massive. They'll make a big difference to our country if we can do it. That means we have to show that the conditions of certainty are there, sufficient for them to put in their lot and come alongside us. So it's not this idea that you can either have, you know, responsible economy or big reform is completely wrong. The only way you get the big reform is by having a secure economy. And that's a fun...
It's a problem, though. The applause was tepid, even for these punchlines that Starmer's giving. The applause was tepid versus the reactions Blair has had, which were genuine. You could hear the room. It came alive. He really has a problem here, I think.
And that's, you know, the discussion that we're having internally in the Labour Party now. I'm absolutely clear about the direction of travel on this.
I mean, I think the other thing that's interesting is that, you know, some of the... So people always say, yeah, but how are you going to do these things? But, for example, in the speech you've just given now, you mentioned planning specifically.
Yep.
And one of the things we've explored today at this conference is in relation, for example, to the clean energy revolution, just how planning's holding us back, right?
Yeah, completely. And I spoke to the CEO of one of our big energy companies not long ago, and I said, look, just assuming for a moment that we are able to come into power and I want to get to clean...
Also, I don't like the cross legs. Tone is sitting in the Chad Alpha manner. Starmer's got his legs crossed like a cuck. Needs to work on that too.
In electricity, clean power by 2030. How quickly could you build me an onshore wind farm? And he said, 2 years. But wow, we're going to be really motoring here. So I said, well, how soon do I get power out of it? He said, oh, that'd be 13 years. I said, well, talk me through that then. He said, I'm going to lose 5 years to planning. And then even when I've done that, I said, well, we're still losing 6 years here. Where does that come from? He said, even when we've done the planning, we've got through that, then the grid will not start crawling towards me until I'm ready to switch the power on. So 13 years. We can't win the race for the next generation of jobs with that. So we're going to have to be really bold on planning and remove those impediments. And this is what I mean by mission-driven government, which is if you get elected into government with five missions, then you are democratically entitled to say that's the direction of travel for our country because we put it to the country and they said we want these fundamental changes. Then got a choice as to how to do it. We could say, well, they're our mission, so we'll suck it all up to the centre and run it through government, which would be a big mistake. Or we can say, well, the missions are clear, so the private sector normally follows and the market's pretty good, so let them get on with it. That won't work. Or we can partner where we say, this is what we're trying to achieve. You are vested in helping us achieve this, and our job is to make sure the conditions are such that you can ensure that happens. So for those onshore wind farms, the job of an incoming Labour government is to say, we're going to deal with planning laws, we're going to deal with all of the problems in infrastructure that are holding this back, and through this partnership deliver, in this case, an onshore wind farm, but there are plenty of other examples, and actually get ahead.
Do you understand what he's suggesting, by the way? I know he's dull, but what he's basically saying here is that they're going to partner with some massive energy company to, I don't know, build a wind farm. If there are laws and regulations and problems in the way, the government then, because they're in partnership with this company, will bulldoze down any of the problems, clear the path, almost like somebody hacking through a jungle, clear the path for that company to get it done in a much shorter amount of time. So it's kind of like, it's a public-private partnership. I mean, if you're that company, quids in, 100% quids in, right? If you're that company. But it sounds like they want that company to put up the investment in the first place, right? But then the government will say, well, you put up the investment, but then you're basically, you're good for the next like 40, 50 years, guaranteed profits. And we will hold the system down to make sure that there's nothing in your way, basically. This is court. I mean, it's basically court. It's corporatism, is what this is. And I mean, while I don't like it, while I personally I don't like the idea of corporatism, it is effective, as shown by the examples of South Korea, and more importantly, China. This is basically a very Chinese way of thinking and doing things, and that is what Starmer and Blair have been suggesting here.
And that, of course, I mean, onshore wind is not just about the climate obligations. It is the single, well, clean energy is the single best way to keep our bills down, to ensure that we have energy security so Putin can't put his boot on our throat. And the next generation of jobs are bound up with this.
I'd be happier if he was talking about nuclear power plants rather than wind farms, by the way.
The Inflation Reduction Act in America is like a magnet for investment at the moment. The EU has responded.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like fascism, the guy in the chat. What they're suggesting is a version of fascism, only I think in fascism the state has the upper hand, whereas I think in this way of doing things, the corporation has the upper hand, I would suggest. And the government almost acts like a kind of point man for the corporation so that it can carry on doing its work.
This government's sitting it out. We've got to turn that around.
I mean, one of the things, obviously, is in relation to the partnership between public and private sector. I mean, I know you spend a lot of time talking to business and to the business community. Have you got from them, is there a set of things that they're looking to from government that you can identify?
Yeah. The first is stability. Economic stability, because they say we're not coming near this until you're... The first thing is stability. The second, a long-term strategy. The missions are intended to be long-term. This is another wind farm example, but it serves the purpose. Whiteley is the biggest onshore wind farm in the UK. It's just outside Glasgow. There's 350 wind turbines there. It's amazing to go and see it. It's like a film set. It's incredible, on the side of the hill there. And when I went there with the CEO of Scottish Power, I looked at them, big, incredible pieces of manufacturing. I said, how many of these were built in the UK then? And he said, none of them. I said, well, why not? He said, because we didn't have a long-term strategy. The government wasn't clear enough, back to your point about chopping through six different prime ministers, and therefore the investors went elsewhere. These were all made in Indonesia, he said. And they were towed in, literally towed in to Scotland and erected there. And so the business is saying security, clear strategic goals, and you're going to stay the course. And then
business is saying, where's your five-year plan? Where's your 10-year plan, mate? Because we need our planning time horizon as well. And I mean, I do think there's some fairness to that point, because given how much money some of these investments cost, if you were a company, why would you bother doing it if you didn't have the guarantee that the next government isn't going to, you know, come and, you know, U-turn on all of these plans?
They've got to be the right goals.
I mean, I think this is one big difference from when we were in, because in a way, you know, that we had a situation where growth was strong, the economy was running reasonably well. I mean, obviously, there were changes that Gordon and myself made that were important, but I think there's a much greater priority now as we enter a new age, industrially, for that partnership between public and private sector.
Yeah. I think it's the only way we can deliver. If you look at the money that's needed to invest in clean power, you can't do it all through state funding. That's never going to get us there on time. So we need that partnership. But we need to create the conditions in which that partnership works.
Right. So health, obviously, is a big... big priority for the Labour Party, always is. You've talked about reform, Keir, and what we talked today a lot about what's possible with a lot of the you know, new technology and the ability to create new treatments, to do better diagnostics, prevention and cure. How much does that fit into the plan of what you need to do with the health service?
It's central. It's absolutely central, the technology and the changes. If you take AI, I mean, you may have had this example today, but a radiologist...
It's just ridiculous. I mean, that question was basically, Keir, all that shit I was talking about earlier on, are you going to do it? Yes, my master. Yes, your will be carried out.
Just working with AI can get us 60% more accurate mental diagnostics on stage one cancer, lung cancer, than we can without. And that is obviously very good news for the individual, but massively important for the NHS, because it costs, if you don't catch it, I mean, we all know this, if you don't...
Think of the bloody chutzpah of this. Future Prime Minister, I am the former Prime Minister. All the stuff I was telling you about, are you going to do it? Yes, I am. Exactly as you said. This is literally this exchange. This is actually happening in broad daylight. And we're just the sorry sods at the end of it all.
Catch cancer till stage four, then you're looking at a much poorer outcome for the individual and a much bigger bill for the NHS. So it's absolutely central. But this goes on the mission on the NHS. We had to be clear. We don't just want to pick the NHS up and put it back on its feet. Of course we want to do that. But I don't want 5 years of Labour government where all we've achieved is managing slightly better the services and institutions as they now are. I want them to be materially better. And the, you know, whatever the mistakes the last 13 years have been many, the challenges facing the NHS are just fundamentally different now to the challenges it faced 75 years ago. And the techniques for dealing with it, the technology has gone so fast,
right?
The AI. So that means we have the opportunity, if we take it, to create an NHS fit for the future, which is technology, it's about prevention, moving health closer to our communities. At the moment, we've got go to the GP or go to A&E as broadly the only options, and you need something close to the communities. Mental health needs to be catered for. So we're talking about a model that will...
I mean, last time they said close to the communities, that was when they let all the bloody... they open the asylums. Was that under Thatcher when they let all the kind of mentalists out into the street? I hope they don't mean that.
Survive for generations to come, not just a slightly better health service at the end of five or more years of a Labour government.
Right, and then obviously if you want to make use of the technology, you've got to build the right digital infrastructure and so on and so forth. That is also really important.
You've got to do all that, but you've also got to take on those that say leave it as it is.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
you will all, particularly in public services.
But here's the thing that you know I found most difficult, I think you find difficult as well, and that is the tendency on the progressive side of politics to define radical simply by the amount of money you're prepared to commit.
Yeah, and this is a big mistake. So I ran a public service for 5 years, the Crown Prosecution Service. I don't need persuading that if you put a bit of money in the top...
That was Blair going, psst, Keir, you sound too left-wing. Come to the centre, sound more Thatchery.
You get a better outcome. But I absolutely know to get a much better outcome, you've got to reform. You've got to take the difficult decisions. And people will say, no, no, it's pretty good. Don't rock the boat. Don't change anything. It all works as it is. But you've got to reform. And an example from when I was running the Crown Prosecution Service, the first thing I did was go around the country to all of our offices to try and learn what our staff were doing on the ground. And I remember it was a sort of freezing cold January day, and I was in South Wales. And we're in the office.
Can I just say, we are witnessing something insane here, which is live on-the-job training by Blair, basically coaching and walking Starmer through his own policies. It's just, it kind of blows my mind that we're watching this, but and that this happened at all. But here we are.
This van pulled up, and then into which were loaded lots and lots of papers. And then it set off over the mountain to the Crown Court for the next day. And when it was en route, one of the cases got switched to a different court, a sort of reverse and go in a different direction. And I said, what is this? And they said, oh, all our files are paper files. I said, well, you must be able to surely move this electronically. No, no, no. We've always done it this way. And so we've got to make use of the technology, we've got to win the argument, but we've also got to win people over to the idea.
Starmer's revolutionary change was getting the Crown Prosecution Service to fucking email its documents. I believe it, to be honest, I believe it. They're so arcane, some of those systems. I do believe it.
This is what is necessary.
Right, that science and technology will be critical to the future. So, Keir, we only short time left. You know, the Labour leader
Blades.
Is always in receipt of an inexhaustible supply of advice on how to lose an election. So the thing that's most difficult, I always think when you're... Because your people... The difference is sort of... You know, when you're in the Conservative Party, you kind of think, right, it's your divine right to govern. So, it's you know, you just get on with it.
Yeah.
Okay?
Look, Blair talking, the room's back, everybody's laughing, everybody's back engaged. You know, shut up, Keir. Tone's back in the room.
I mean, I think they're a bit different now. But but with the Labour Party, you know, the people want... They want this sense of enthusiasm. They want to be enthusiastic about what they're going to do. I mean, when you look back, the other difference between us is that I was lucky enough to have Neil Kinnock and John Smith before me. You know, you weren't, right?
I've mentioned this before that Starmer's got a lot to do in a very short amount of time, and they recognise this.
Put it like that. So, I just want in the last bit because. People should acknowledge what you have done since 2019, because I tell you, it was not easy. Woo!
Woo! This is literally this whole room of Blair sycophants clapping, whooping and cheering for Starmer's execution of Order 66, right? Blair sent Starmer in to kill, you know, take out the younglings. You know, they went over to the bloody separatist council and he scythed down, what's his name? you know, Newt Gunray and all the rest of them. And now they're whooping and cheering for the fact that Starmer has cleared out the Corbynistas.
Acknowledge what you have done since 2019, because I tell you, it was not easy. In the closing minute, like, how? How
well,
is it done?
I'd just pick you up on your interest. I mean, we're trying to do Kinnock, Smith and Blair in one run and to do it in 5 years. And that is has meant we've had to go at pace. And it meant we've had to be really ruthless and tough. We couldn't, you know, along the way, when we got to difficult decisions, people have said to me, don't do it this year, Keir. Leave it. We'll do it at court.
Yeah, exactly. So this is how democracy dies, with thunderous applause. For a more prosperous and stable and secure empire.
Conference next year. And we've had to go at this at pace because we haven't got the time to waste on this. And every day I remind myself that to get from where we land in 2019 to a one-seat Labour majority, a one-seat Labour majority is going to take a bigger swing than 1997. And if that doesn't sober you, I often talk about politics as a sort of sharp in take a breath. That gives me a sharp in take a breath every time I say it because people are inhaling the polls. And that is a big, big, big mistake. But there are then just fundamental... So we had the first thing we had to do was change the party. And I don't know whether this is because I came into politics later in life, etc. But when you lose that badly, I strongly believe you don't look at the electorate and say, what on earth were you doing? Didn't you listen to us? Should we shout a bit louder? You look in the mirror and say, we got this wrong. We've got to change as a party. And we had to change as a party at speed. I also felt strongly that we didn't...
That was Starmer's best bit, by the way, both in his speech and in this whole interview. That little bit, he came alive a little bit more, basically talking about how he did in the Corbynistas. This was his strongest moment. He was actually obviously most excited about this part.
Really have the right to say how we'd run the country until we'd done the change. People were not going to listen to the Labour Party until we showed we had changed and changed for a good purpose. Second bit was then, and we had to be really unrelenting on that, really clear, difficult decisions, and change is never finished. But we got as far as then the next stage, which is to expose the government as not fit to govern. Now, we've been ably assisted in that, I have to admit, by the last three prime ministers. And now we get to that place of, well, if not them, then why you? But this is where, you know, because all along the way I've had the advice, you know, when we're at the stage of we've got to change the party, the people yelling from the sidelines saying, where's your vision? Go bolder, go bigger. And I said, we've got to fix the party first. We've got to change the party first. So there will be people all along the journey telling you to do it in a different order, but we had to do it in that order. But now we get the chance to lay out the change that an incoming Labour government would put. But if we hadn't changed the party, it would be as naught, because I strongly think that the electorate don't usually look to change the government if they're pretty happy with it, if things are all right. But when they think, it's not all right. Actually, I've had enough of you lot. I want some change. And I think we're at that moment. Then there's a laser focus on, well, what's the alternative then? And if we hadn't changed the Labour Party, then they'd be looking at us and saying, nah, we're not going to do that. So that's why the next stage is where we've got to be even tougher, even more focused, even more disciplined. And I've said to...
Focus on discipline. Focus.
To the shadow cabinet and others, to get this over the line at the next general election, we've got to be exceptional over the period that we've got left between now and that general election.
Well, you know, if how far you've taken the Labour Party in the last 4 years is any guide to how far you can take the country, we'll be in good hands. Thank you very much indeed.
What you're seeing here, come on, I always say, like, politics is like pro wrestling, right? You remember back in the 80s, Vince was trying to get over a new star. How would you establish that new star? Well, it's Hulk Hogan, who you already love. And now his friend to the end, Brutus Beefcake, or Tugboat, or whoever it happens to be. And this was basically Blair giving the rub, as they call it in pro wrestling terms, to Keir Starmer, giving Starmer his blessing, giving Starmer his endorsement to try to rub off some of that shine that Blair already has, because he's already established, he's already a big star, especially with this crowd, of kind of liberal technocratic elites, which is basically the crowd that Starmer's trying to get over with here. Tone is a massive name in those circles and in the country, less so with the public for various reasons. But with this crowd, Tone is the man. And this is basically Blair trying to get Starmer over with this set, basically.
Yep.
And you can actually see, right? You can actually see some of the headlines basically echoing what I'm saying, right? So if you just, something I like to do, go on Google, Blair and Starmer bask in each other's reflected glory, right? Starmer recast Blair model for Age of Insecurity. Blair gave Starmer his blessing and he needs it. In his interview with Tony Blair, was Keir Starmer looking in a mirror? Right? So that is basically what the papers are saying. The Daily Mail are saying what some of you said. Keir Starmer banged on and on as Tony Blair's eyes glazed over. Part of that is true, I'm afraid. Part of that is true. And that is a bit of a problem, I think, that Tone is going to need to work with Starmer on going forward. So just before I get out of here, I will hit some super chats. Sam 153 says, enjoying the summer of Tone. What drink do you suggest while tanning with Tone? Well, it's the summer, so why not a pina colada with a little umbrella and a piece of pineapple on the top? Why not pina colada? You could say it's you could say Starmer's like Ultimate Warrior, they're really trying to push him, but he's a crap worker or whatever. But anyway. Dollface says, Keir Starmer looks like he's a different person wearing a Mission Impossible style mask of Keir Starmer. I mean, yeah, there is that. Death says, you were right about him not being charismatic. Started daydreaming when Starmer was talking. I was only brought back when you paused and started talking. Yeah, that is. I would noticed in the chat that a lot of people were glazing over whenever Starmer talked. That's a problem. And I am sure back at Tony Blair Institute HQ, that's what Blair will be talking about tonight. They'll be sitting around a table doing a debrief thinking, what are we going to do about that? How are we going to... So in pro wrestling terms, you see, you can always, you can get someone and you can work around their limitations, right? You can work around their limitations. In wrestling, you could have like a guy who was really charismatic, but a bad worker. And you could basically hide his flaws and protect him by putting him in the ring with lots of good workers. Classic example would be Junkyard Dog back in the Mid-South days. And it'd be like, Bill Watts would be like, right, Junkyard Dog, you know, pretty charismatic, but he's a dog shit worker. So what do we do? Stick him in there with DiBiase. We'll put him in there with, Terry Gordy, DiBiase and me, say, and we can hide all of Junkyard Dog's weaknesses because the other three guys in the ring will make him look like $1 million, right? Or you can have the opposite problem where they're pretty good in the ring, but they have no charisma whatsoever, right? This is closer to the Keir Starmer problem, where Starmer's good at the being ruthless leader, the backroom politics, like he's disciplined, he knows how to run a department, right? So he's got some decent stats in the back room, right? His technical stats are good. When it comes to the brute, like he's a good bruiser, basically, and he gets shit done, okay? Water, no promo skills. And in wrestling, what they do is they'd stick, they'd get somebody like that, and they'd stick him with a manager, like a Paul Heyman, or they'd stick him with a good talker. And what Blair is going to have to do, basically, is surround Starmer with people who can kind of talk on his behalf. So he's going to need a good team around him. The trouble I am seeing, exactly like Chungus in WWID, Spasticus, you know, she's got a good crew around her, or she has up until now. The problem that New Labour in their current New Labour 2.0 have is that they don't have that many good workers. They don't have that many really charismatic people in the front bench. Probably one of the reasons that Tone is trying to help by appearing on stage with him and trying to like walk him through this, hoping that some of his charisma will rub off a little bit. But they're going to have to find some people, right? Even back in the day, as we've seen, Blair had other characters, like Prescott had charisma, and some of the other New Labour guys could talk a little bit, you know. Alan Johnson was a good old-fashioned trade union guy. They could all cut a promo, you know. They're going to have to work on that. I mean, I did see earlier on that Liz Kendall was in the studio. But is Liz Kendall an MP anymore, or is she just a TV personality now? Is she a former MP now? Or is she actually... Oh, no, Liz Kendall is still an MP, right? I mean, Liz Kendall has got some media presence, I guess. She knows how to talk. It's going to have to be better than Kendall, though. It's going to have to be like... They need to find some people. What they're going to have to do, basically, is... They're going to have to, if Starmer's going to win, you've got to remember that means there's going to be a shitload of New Labour MPs who we don't know, newcomers into the party, right? So the current Labour backbenchers aren't very good to go into an election with because they're, you know, there's still a lot of Corbynistas in there, a lot of shitheads in the party, a lot of crap talent. Right. So what Starmer needs to do and what Blair needs to do, I don't know why I'm giving this advice for free. And they know this anyway. These guys are masters. Are there. Mandelson will be there running the show and Campbell and so on. They need to find really charismatic people that they can stick in all of the seats that they expect to pick up from the Tories in this election. And those people are going to form the backbone of the new Starmer cabinet. It can't be the people who are currently there because they're crap, basically. I mean, that's something for them to sort out between now and then. But they are going to have to somehow get those people who are running to be MPs, who are not MPs currently, a lot of TV spots, a lot of media time. They're going to need to get them over quickly with the crowd, right? It's not that difficult because David Cameron did it. All of the current MPs, all of the current Tory front benchers and the Bravermans and Priti Patel and all of them, they all came from the Cameron lot, right? They were all newcomers in the Cameron party. So it's possible to do that. And that's what's going to have to happen. And then Starmer's lack of charisma can be compensated for by a bunch of really good talkers in, you know, who they can get over on TV, start embedding them. And I think that's the reason why we're seeing quite a lot of old Blairites, people from back in, you know, the 2000s back on TV, and Campbell and people like that back in the media. Because at the moment, those are the faces that people know. But they're going to have to establish new stars. They can't rely on Blair-era people for the new government. So that's going to have to be something. Exactly, the 2002 OVW class, exactly. Okay. There we go. I mean, there's nobody there right now. But what I'm saying is they're going to have to find people who are really good at being on TV and who are charismatic, who they can basically stick in a lot of TV interviews and build those people around Starmer, right? I mean, this has happened in the past. I'll give you a good example of a cabinet that had a lot of big characters in it with basically a charisma vacuum at the center, and that was Clement Attlee. Clement Attlee was not a good talker. Clement Attlee was not a big personality. Clement Attlee was really quiet and managerial and didn't give good speeches and things like that. But he had a lot of big personalities in that cabinet. You know, the Nye Bevans and people like that. People who got stuff done, people who gave good speeches. So it's possible. It's just a different way of having, you know, it's just a different style of leader, I guess, right? I mean, to an extent, FDR was a bit like that as well. You can have a kind of quieter managerial leader who lets other people take the limelight a little bit. You know, John Major, to an extent, was a prime minister like that. He was still the prime minister for 7 years, don't forget. And he had a lot of big personalities in his cabinet. Portillo and Heseltine and, you know, all of the other people who were in the Major cabinet, they were still around. So, yeah, it's possible. All right. Thank you very much, guys. I'll see you soon. Shall we do a little play out? Bye, everyone. Bye. Remember the promo code MERIT. Join the channel. Pick up a course at the academic agency. Subscribe to my Substack. But most importantly of all, get out. Traveling across the sea.